Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 5, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone is on the Bond versus U.S. case, decided earlier this week by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back two experts today, both return guests to Teleforum. We'll hear opening remarks from each of them in about 8 to 10 minutes, then a little back and forth, and then, as always, we'll be turning to our audience for your questions, so please be ready with those questions. We're going to hear first today from Professor Nicholas Quinn Rosenkranz. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. And he will be followed by Dr. John C. Eastman. He is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at the Chapman University School of Law. Their longer and more complete bios have been provided to you in the notice of today's call and are available on our website, so my introductions are brief accordingly. And with that, Professor Rosenkranz, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks very much, Dean, and thanks to the Federal Society for putting this together. So we're talking today about Bond versus United States, a case that came down from the Supreme Court earlier this week. And this is a terrific case. It's one of those rare cases that has a great legal issue, but also deliciously lurid facts, so people enjoy that. Mrs. Bond discovered that her husband was having an affair with her neighbor. And so she did what really anyone would do, which is she got a bunch of toxic chemicals and went across the street and put them on the car door and on the doorknob and on the doormat and on the mailbox of the neighbor. Now, we should make clear, apparently she was not actually trying to kill the neighbor. She was just trying to cause her an unpleasant rash. The neighbor successfully avoided these chemicals on all but one occasion when she touched a doorknob and apparently got a little thumb burn. She ran cold water over it and was then fine. So this conduct by Mrs. Bond is obviously not to be condoned, and it is, of course, all kinds of state crime. For example, assault, right? She violated the Pennsylvania assault statute. However, she wasn't tried for violation of these Pennsylvania laws. Rather, she was tried for violation of a federal statute. So an assistant United States attorney, I think it's safe to say an ambitious assistant United States attorney, charged her with violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act. And now, you know, as you can perhaps derive from the name, this was a statute that really was contemplating, you know, terrorist acts or acts by nation states or whatever, and not really contemplating this sort of domestic dispute. But, you know, Mrs. Bond seems to fit. She tried to harm her neighbor with some, you know, harmful chemicals, and so she seems to fit within the language of the statute. She's tried pursuant to this federal statute. And Mrs. Bond says two things. First, she says, I don't think the statute really covers me. It may look like it does, the text of it seems like it does, but it shouldn't be construed that broadly. We should really construe it to be more about, you know, terrorism or warlike uses of these chemicals, not this sort of thing. So that's her first point, is a statutory point. Her second point, though, is I don't see how Congress has power to enact this statute. Whence Congress's power over this topic? As a general matter, when we're trying to determine whether Congress has power to enact a statute, we look at the list of congressional powers in Article 1, Section 8. And Mrs. Bond said, I've had a look at that list, and I don't see anything about chemical weapons in the list. So where does Congress get this power? Now, the government said something interesting in reply. They said, first of all, they said, we think the statute does cover you. But then second, they said, it doesn't matter that you don't see this in the list. It doesn't matter that this is not apparently one of our enumerated powers, and the reason is this. We've entered into this treaty, which is called the Chemical Weapons Convention, and a treaty governing the regulation of chemical weapons. And that the fact that we entered into this treaty actually gives us the power. Congress has new legislative power exactly because we entered into this treaty. So, or to put the finest point on it, the government's theory is a treaty can increase the legislative power of Congress. Even if Congress didn't have the power to enact the statute before, now they have it because there's this treaty. That was the government's theory. And the government has a good case for that theory, which is Missouri v. Holland, 1920, in which Justice Holmes seemed to say exactly that, seemed to say that a treaty can increase the legislative power of Congress. He seemed to say that in 1920. Now, in 2005, in the Harvard Law Review, I said that I thought that was wrong, that actually a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress. And so this case posed that interesting, rich question. Can a treaty increase the legislative power of Congress? That's what we were all hoping would be the heart of this opinion that came down on Monday. Now, what happened, to my mind, unfortunately, is that the Chief Justice, writing for himself and five other justices, decided the case on that statutory question. So the Chief said, actually, the statute doesn't even reach you, Mrs. Bond, even though it seems like it does, even though the language of it seems pretty clear. We're going to construe it not to reach this sort of conduct. And the opinion has a bit of the flavor of we'll avoid the hard constitutional question, has a little bit of the flavor of we're going to honor federalism concerns and assume that Congress didn't want to interfere in these very sort of local state-type crimes. And so we'll construe the statute not to reach this kind of conduct, even though the language seems pretty clear. And that's the opinion of the court, six justices, this rather narrow statutory interpretation holding the statute just doesn't reach Mrs. Bond. Now, more interestingly, there are three other opinions, which are concurrences. So the opinion actually, the case is 9-0. All nine of them think that Mrs. Bond should win. But three of the justices, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, actually believe that the statute is crystal clear, and that it does cover Mrs. Bond. And so they are obliged to answer this harder question of did Congress actually have authority to enact this statute? And as to that point, perhaps the most compelling opinion is Justice Scalia's opinion concurring in the judgment, in which he says no. Missouri v. Holland was quite wrong. Justice Holmes was quite wrong in this one sentence in which he seemed to say the opposite. In fact, a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress. And he wrote that for himself and for Justice Thomas. Justice Alito did not sign on, but if you piece together what he said, it seems like he might agree with that. He doesn't commit one way or the other, but we have at least two justices for this quite striking opinion, which is actually a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress, and Missouri v. Holland is wrong. So that's the opinion that I think we were all hoping would be would command a majority of the court, but we're still gratified to have two justices on record saying that. So I think that tees the issue up, and I think John's going to help to put this in sort of broader context of what's going on at the court, and then we can get into a bit of a discussion.
Thanks, Nick. Terrific. One thing, Nick is unduly humble here because Justice Scalia's opinion cites at a critical point, see generally Rosencrantz executing the treaty power, and cites that Harvard Law Review article from 2005. And we also should give Nick kudos because the reason Missouri versus Holland seemed untouchable for so long is some very prominent scholarship decades ago that had seemed to ratify it, that line from Oliver Wendell Holmes as a matter of original interpretation because of specific things that occurred during the Federal Convention in 1787. And Nick's scholarship here blew that out of the water, that the prior scholarship had been based on a misreading of the convention debates. And once you understood what part of the convention debates were being addressed and what was being amended, the old scholarship was just flat out wrong. Now, theoretically, Missouri versus Holland has always been on tenuous grounds, but now with that specific new scholarship that Nick brought to the table, it's even more clear-cut that it's clearly wrong. Let me put it in the broader context of the fight over Missouri versus Holland, and then I'm going to talk about the context of Scalia versus Roberts, and there's some very interesting dynamics playing out in this case here as well. As you all may know, I am the founder of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which is a public interest law firm devoted to recovering the original understanding of the Constitution. We have kind of informally a dirty dozen list of erroneous cases that have devastated our jurisprudence and our understanding of the Constitution that our mission is to overturn. And one of them is Missouri versus Holland. And I think Missouri versus Holland is kind of reflects the goals of the progressive movement of the last century, which is to remove all impediments to government power. And Justice Scalia, in his opinion, has a wonderful line that kind of puts this in context. He says, "But in Holland, the proponents of unlimited congressional power found a loophole through the limitations on federal government power doctrine. They said, by negotiating a treaty and obtaining the requisite consent of the Senate, the president may endow Congress with a source of legislative authority independent of the powers enumerated in Article 1. Quoting Professor Larry Tribe's very prominent constitutional law treatise. And that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what Oliver Wendell Holmes was trying to do. And we're seeing increasingly administrations, particularly the current administration, using both executive international agreements and treaties to expand the scope of federal power over domestic relations, not having anything to do with relations between nation states. So we find it on the implementation of the International Treaty on the Child and all of these other things where they can't get their agenda through the legislature. They just say, we'll sign a codicil to some treaty out there that will give us the power to regulate our own citizens, having nothing to do with international relations because we've tacked on to a treaty power. And as the court enforces the limits on enumerated powers, this exemption, this way around that doctrine of the treaty power has become increasingly tantalizing for the proponents of unlimited federal government. And so overruling Missouri versus Holland is a critically important thing. The case in 1950s, Reed versus Covert, that said the Bill of Rights can't be trumped by treaty is, of course, correct, but they've never applied that same analysis to whether the enumerated powers doctrines can be trumped by treaty. And Justice Scalia makes a powerful an extremely persuasive case here. I say that because it almost reads like the brief Nick and I filed in the case, so that's one of the reasons why we're so happy with it. In fact, I suspect if we did a document compare, we'd find a lot of overlap in the two. Let me talk briefly about Justice Thomas's separate opinion. He joined Justice Scalia's, and Justice Scalia and Justice Alito both joined Justice Thomas's. Justice Thomas comes at the limitations on the treaty power from a different direction, which might even have a greater limitation on it than Justice Scalia's analysis itself does, and that is, what is treaty power? The Constitution doesn't define it, but the understanding by those who wrote and ratified the Constitution was that a treaty was an agreement between sovereign nations on how they deal with each other. Not something that would create requirements for how a nation deals with its own citizens unless they affected or dealt with international relations. So, for example, I can limit property rights of my citizens in Virginia when they are claiming property against a British national property that was taken during the Revolutionary War because that treaty settled that issue. That has a domestic impact, but it's directly related to our relations internationally. And Justice Thomas says that's the limit on the treaty power. It can't be used to determine how our government deals otherwise with our own citizens. And I think that's a very powerful limitation on the treaty power that had not been well established in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence yet either. So that's why this case is so important and why these two opinions are very important markers for ultimately overruling Missouri versus Holland. Now, let me speak briefly about this other fight that I see going on in the court between Justice Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts here. Justice Scalia does not mince any words in his concurring in the judgment opinion about the inappropriateness of what Chief Justice Roberts did in the majority opinion. He says the court shirks its job and performs Congress's, because what Chief Justice Roberts did here is completely rewrite an unambiguous statute. It's kind of the flip side of the coin of what he did 2 years ago in the healthcare decision, completely rewrote a statute in order to save its constitutionality. Here he completely rewrote a statute to strike it down so he could avoid having to reach the constitutional question, which was much more significant. And like I say, Justice Scalia doesn't mince any words. He says at one point, the court's account reads like a really good lawyer's brief for the wrong side, relying on cases that are oh so close to being on point that someone eager to reach the favored outcome might swallow them. The language like that throughout Justice Scalia's opinion. So I can't quite tell whether he's really miffed at what the Chief Justice did here, standalone, or whether he's continuing to be miffed with what happened 2 years ago, which was quite frankly a change in vote. The evidence, I think, is persuasive on that. And Justice Scalia is famous for not pulling his punches in his dissents, but normally it's been reserved for the other side. Here he's going after supposedly somebody on his own side of the ideological spectrum of the court. There's another point, though, that Justice Scalia makes here, and I think it's important. When the court thinks they can rewrite the statutes to achieve particular outcomes they want, that really is a judge-enhancing action. And so in many ways, what Chief Justice Roberts has done with this majority opinion is not unlike what Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, again, the famous progressive who kind of wreaked havoc on our constitutional jurisprudence, what he did in the famous case of Erie versus Tompkins, where on its face the case looked like it is curtailing the power of the federal government, when what is in fact doing is expanding the power of the judiciary. And Justice Scalia takes this on head on. He says, once again, contemplate the judge empowering consequences of the new interpretive rule the court announces today. When there is dissonance between a statutory definition and an ordinary meaning of a defined word, the ordinary meaning will prevail as the court decides, rather than what the statute explicitly says. And Justice Scalia calls that a judge-empowering ruling, and indeed it is. So there's still a lot of fight here, but it's nice to have Justice Scalia 100% on board and attacking these kind of progressive movement derogations of our constitutional jurisprudence and really calling it for what it is.
All right, this is Dean Reuter. We're going to go back to Professor Rosenkranz, but before we do that, Professor, let me just open up the floor to questions so people can begin ringing in. In a moment, everyone will hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our experts, push star and then pound. And with that, let's go back to Professor Rosenkranz.
Great. So while questions are queuing up, maybe I'll just say a couple more words. I agree with virtually everything John said, and I'm quite grateful, John's nice of you to mention mention my article. So I appreciate that. Maybe we should just take one more second and focus on just quite how important this particular issue is as a structural matter. So many of us spend a lot of time trying to figure out the scope of congressional power, the scope of those powers in this list in Article 1, Section 8. And in particular, a lot of us have spent a lot of time and energy fighting about the scope of the Commerce Clause and saying the Commerce Clause, it may be very broad, but it is not infinite. There are some things that Congress cannot reach with the Commerce Clause. That would seem like a constitutional axiom, and it's been a hugely important fight for many of us. Now, if Missouri v. Holland is right, though, there is, as Justice Scalia says, this loophole. There is this loophole. So if Congress, Article 1, Section 8 powers are limited, and there's something Congress wants to do that it does not have power to do under the list, under Missouri v. Holland, it can get around this problem. All it needs to do is find any foreign country willing to agree with it about anything. So they, if the president can find Zimbabwe and make an agreement about guns near schools or violence against women or requiring people to buy health insurance or whatever else it might be, then under Missouri v. Holland, suddenly Congress would get that power, even though they don't have that power today. And so if that's true, that's a, you know, you can kind of drive a truck through this loophole in this constitutional axiom of limited federal power. That's why this is so important, and that's why it's crucial for Justice Scalia and Thomas to be on record saying that cannot be right. And, you know, it's important to note, too, those two justices said that can't be right. The others, though, didn't take a position as to that because the six were deciding on this narrow statutory ground. So as to that point, on this day, the score is 2-0, right? There's Scalia and Thomas on one side, and there's nobody writing to say that that's wrong. So so for now, we know two justices think Missouri v. Holland is wrong, and we don't know what the others think. And so Missouri v. Holland remains the law of the land, but in a proper case, there is hope that the court will do the right thing.
Once again, if you have a question for our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple callers lined up here. So with that, let's go to our first caller.
Todd Holland, Constitution.org. It seems one thing missing from the analysis of Missouri v. Holland is that there may have been a presumption on the part of the court that Congress did have the authority to regulate migratory birds, presumably under the Commerce Clause, and therefore they would not be exercising an extra constitutional power. But
that,
also,
yeah,
missing. Also missing from the argument is an invocation of the ancient law of agency, that an agent derives his power explicitly from a contract with the principal, the sovereign, and he cannot get additional power derived from concluding a deal with a third party. So if this were simply brought out and made clear, the issues might become a lot easier to argue and to get agreement on.
Thanks very much. Let me take those up. I think at the time Missouri versus Holland was decided, everybody agreed that the Commerce Clause power did not extend to covering things that were not articles of commerce, and migratory birds were not articles of commerce. That case then proceeds on the basis of that assumption that the commerce power was insufficient to support the domestic regulation that was issued. And Justice Holmes says, but we have a treaty, and it's always within the Congress's power to implement a treaty as long as the treaty is valid. Now, it turns out that's not true.
John, if I could just interrupt you, I'm not sure I agree that everyone agreed. In fact, I think Justice Holmes might not have agreed. I think Justice Holmes actually knew exactly what he was doing, which was creating an end run around this limit on the Commerce Clause, which he maybe didn't believe in.
Well, that's right. That's right. But he writes it as if the Commerce Clause didn't reach that, so he can ratify the statute anyway.
Correct.
Yeah. And on the second point, Mr. Rowland, the issue here is if the treaty power is authorized as part of the Constitution, so the sovereign has given that power to its agents, then they're not violating that delegation of power if the treaty power is in fact as broad or was intended to be as broad, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said. So the fight is over whether how limited or how broad the delegation of treaty power was intended to be by those who ratified the Constitution. And you know, you parse the statute and the combination of the necessary and proper clause with the treaty power, Congress's power under the Necessary and Proper Clause is to help implement the power to make treaties. It is not the power to implement whatever the treaty decides to do. And Justice Scalia's opinion here, again, you know, drawing heavily from our brief, is I think, perfectly on point, that whether you can implement a particular provision of a treaty turns on whether the Constitution authorizes the exercise of that power in the first place.
Professor Rosenkranz, do you have more on this point?
Yeah, I quite agree with John. I think maybe what the questioner was trying to get at was, you know, maybe the treaty power is, you know, as it were, a power to enter into contracts with other nations, but there's no reason to think that entering into the contract is going to somehow give you new power. It's the treaty power is a power to enter into an agreement about how you're going to use the powers that you already have. It's not going to change the scope of your power. It's the ability to make agreements about use of power that you already possess. I think that's what the questioner's agency point was driving at, and I think if that's what he was driving at, I think that's basically right.
All right, we've got three more callers on the line with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button to join the queue. Before we do that, let me announce that next Monday, which is our next scheduled Teleform conference call, we're going to be discussing potential legal issues resulting from the closing of Gitmo. Will detainees transferred to U.S. soil enjoy new legal rights and avenues of appeal? So that is next Monday. Take a look at the Federal Society website for more details and other calls that might be scheduled between then and now. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi. This is Brad Clark, professor at GW Law School. My question is, where does this go from here? In other words, if the court could find a pretty clear statute ambiguous and avoid the question, isn't that a tactic that they would take for the foreseeable future? And isn't that just a way to live to fight another day, which is why I assume it was 9-0? Because it seems like the facts were pretty good in this case. If they were going to do something on the constitutional issue, they had good facts, but they didn't take that opportunity. So are there any other cases on the horizon, and how do you think they'll handle them?
I'm not aware of any other cases on the horizon. Maybe John can answer that. How will the court handle them? You know, I think we can still imagine that there might be a statute that was even clearer than this, such that it really was not susceptible of the narrowing construction, and then they would really have to answer the question. Now, I would have said that this was that case, but, you know, I suppose we can imagine a statute that's yet even clearer and, you know, conduct that's yet even more clearly covered by the statute, and then, you know, everybody would have to wrestle with the constitutional question. But I agree with you. I mean, this is such an implausible, in my view, statutory reading that you could think, well, you know, if they can do that with this one, they'll be able to do it with anyone. So, you know, I agree.
Yeah, and if
And Justice Scalia takes this up. So just ponder what the court says. The act's ambiguity derives from the improbably broad reach of the key statutory definition. So the court is admitting that it is finding ambiguity where none exists, because of the clear text of the statute reached so broadly, and that can't possibly be what they had in mind, says the court, and so therefore we're going to interpret it as being ambiguous when it's perfectly clear. Now, that's just Justice Scalia again uses that phrase "judge empowering" in describing that aspect of it as well. That's exactly what it is. We can strike down laws that are unbelievably clear if we don't like the constitutional implications by pretending there's an ambiguity there when there is not, to avoid having to deal with a constitutional question that would force us to limit the scope of power of the federal government. And again, this is the progressive ideology writ large in this opinion, that, you know, we ought to have every presumption in favor of the Congress being able to do whatever it wants, or the federal government being able to do whatever it wants. And it's odd in this case that they strike down an act of Congress, but by doing so, they enhance the powers of the federal government to do more broadly things that beyond what the Constitution authorized.
Yeah, I mean, and if I could just add, the court's done this before in the context of congressional attempts to remove jurisdiction from the courts, but this takes it another step. I mean, this is arrogating more power to the court to avoid questions that it really shouldn't be avoiding.
No, that's right. And I think that opening line from Justice Scalia, today the court shirks its job and performs Congress's, I think is very apt.
I think John's putting the point very well. So there's something almost definitionally circular about this analytical move that the court is making. This raises a difficult constitutional question, and thus the statute must be ambiguous. And if you can do that here, you can do it every time, and you'll never have to answer a constitutional question, or never have to answer a question about the scope of Congress's power. So, I completely agree about that. It is worrisome.
Here's another bit from Scalia's opinion, just to show you how I think really angry. There is nothing either realistic or well known about the presumption the court shoves down the throat of a resisting statute today.
We still got a handful of questions pending, so let's take another call.
Hi, Larry Callahan. I wanted to kind of raise the same issue that was raised before, but it's kind of been addressed. It seems to me it's like a juggler who's lost track of some of the balls in the air, particularly the important ones. And I wondered whether there were cert petitions or cases pending that raised the same arguments. I also wanted to say hello to John, but apparently from what you said, there aren't. It just seemed to me that might explain this if there was something that might give them a better opportunity to address it. But it seems to me it's kind of odd that they didn't address some of these important issues. But I enjoyed the discussion.
No, but I'll tell you what, though, and again, Justice Scalia raises this red flag, that what you've now done is give due process arguments to a whole slew of people that have been prosecuted under federal criminal statutes that have some federalism overlay or concern with it, that the clear statute should nevertheless be held to be narrower than the conduct covered because of the federalism concerns without ever having to reach the question of whether the statute is itself invalid. And you're going to see a slew of criminal defense lawyers raising those arguments. I think, quite frankly, with just reason, based on this opinion.
I'll just explain briefly why, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of cases waiting in the wings. If you think about this issue, you're trying to drive at the question of, can a treaty increase the legislative power of Congress? But under current Commerce Clause doctrine, the power of Congress is close to infinite anyway. That is, there's very little that Congress cannot do under its Commerce Clause power under current doctrine. You know, we have Lopez, we have Morrison, and we have, some of the language in the Obamacare case. But these are very few little data points that are beyond where there's a statute that we know is beyond Congress's power. And this Missouri v. Holland question only arises in those circumstances. And it's only when the treaty is promising that Congress will do something that Congress otherwise lacks the power to do. That's why it was hard even for us to, come up with the hypotheticals. But so my hypotheticals were, agreeing with Zimbabwe about guns near schools. That example works because of Lopez. But I don't have a lot of examples like that because there are not a lot of data points about things that are beyond Congress's power. That's why it's actually hard for a set of facts to arise that quite give you a clear cut at this. The odd quirk of Bond was that the government actually waived reliance on the Commerce Clause. And that's what gave us a clean cut at the Missouri v. Holland issue. But, in subsequent cases, you can be sure the government will always be waiving the Commerce Clause around.
But I do.
What were the circumstances? Why did the government waive the Commerce Clause in this case? Do you know?
Yeah, I think they're setting up the broader treaty power. They want ratification of Missouri versus Holland because I think a lot of the domestic political fights we're having right now are already moving offshore via treaties and conventions and codicils and what have you, including both Morrison and United States versus Lopez. And these are not far-fetched hypotheticals on how they will press this issue. So a British citizen visiting the United States gets caught up in a in an assault with a gun that happens to be in a school zone. And so the president decides to expand upon a treaty we already have with Great Britain, protecting British citizens while they're visiting here, and adds an overruling of United States Lopez to the treaty understanding. Then the same thing with the Violence Against Women Act provisions that were struck down in Morrison. The international treaties and conventions on the rights of women or whatever are perfect fodder for expanding that power there. And I quite frankly think that they want that expanded power because there's a lot more they can get done through United Nations agencies and treaties, particularly these multilateral treaties that are becoming so frequent, than they could ever possibly get through the legislature here or pass the Supreme Court that at least has some outer limits on the power of Congress.
And if they didn't get the loss here, they didn't quite get the ratification from the court either, did they?
No, they did not. They did not. Yeah. And the only thing they got is two very strong opinions joined by one or the other, by three justices, that there is a limitation on the treaty power.
It is very odd that the government disclaimed reliance on the Commerce Clause here. I have a theory. I have no evidence, but I'll offer you my theory anyway. When this case was percolating, the Obamacare case was also percolating. And I think at that moment, it seemed to the government that the Commerce Clause argument here was a little bit dicey and a little bit aggressive, you know, something about, well, these chemicals might have traveled in interstate commerce or something. And, you know, given the Commerce Clause gravamen of the Obamacare case, they kind of didn't want to push their luck about commerce right at that moment. On the other hand, their treaty argument and their Missouri v. Holland argument looked very easy. Looks like a slam dunk. This is fine. See Missouri v. Holland, period. And then the Obamacare case comes down, and then the Third Circuit says, well, yes, you're right about Missouri v. Holland, but it seems crazy to us, and we urge the court to take another look. And suddenly, their treaty argument didn't look so great, and they wished they were back on the Commerce Clause course. So they actually tried to revive it at the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court was having none of it. But I think that was a bit of the strategy, such as it was.
Fascinating. We've got three callers pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, gentlemen, this is Joseph Silva in Florida. How are you all?
Pretty well, thanks.
Good. Forgive my ignorance. Let me run this by you here, though. In terms of the, and you may have addressed it early on, but the implications on executive authority, the additional broader expansion, what do we see here? Clearly, my impression would be that this would clearly support it, but attacking the executive order issue regarding administration of certain executive agencies, along those lines, are there any challenges to the expansion of executive authority? In terms of rulemaking, insofar as they go hand in hand to the extent that we're looking at extra-constitutional, I would put to you, efforts to essentially enact what we've characterized as a progressive agenda. And quite frankly, the notion that you've got multilaterals and NGOs and us joining up and signing up with a bunch of treaties that are going to then have the effect of trumping state law as well as any multitude of things, you're painting a very troublesome picture.
Well, I guess what I'd say about executive power generally and executive orders is it's actually a bit far afield from our issue here in Bond, but it is quite a live discussion. This is a different discussion about the president's duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And that is a thing that people are talking about. I testified before the House Judiciary Committee on that topic in January, and you can find that hearing online if you're interested in it. In short, there are many different instances in which one could challenge what this president has done as not being consistent with the duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. But that's quite a different issue from what we're talking about here, which is scope of congressional power.
Yeah, but there are a lot of kind of permutations on the treaty power that may raise additional concerns here. So the one we're dealing with here in Bond is the treaty implementing the International Convention Against Chemical Weapons and a statute that implements that. That treaty was signed by the president and ratified by the Senate. But there are a whole slew of things that, particularly with these broad multilateral treaties, that give the president additional authority by executive order to take certain steps in fulfilling treaty obligations. And if those steps exceed the powers that the federal government has under Article 1, Section 8, would those raise similar Missouri versus Holland issues? And then you have the president not negotiating in a treaty but an executive agreement. And can he do by those executive agreements things that would exceed the Article 1, Section 8 enumeration of powers as well? And so there are lots of collateral issues as the president and his administration offload more and more of these kind of decisions to international forums. There may be more opportunities for mischief and more opportunities to litigate this issue.
Quite right. I agree about all that.
And this is Dean Reuter. I'd also direct the caller and other interested folks to the event audio of the Federal Society's recently concluded second annual Executive Branch Review Conference, where we delve into a lot of these issues in a variety of different panel discussions. Three questions pending, so let's take another call.
Yes, this is George Brown calling from Boston, and I may have misheard the earlier discussion. I've always thought that Missouri v. Holland was wrong, and I thought I heard a comparison of it to Erie versus Tompkins as a progressive decision in the same vein of national authority.
Yeah, no, this is John Eastman. I was comparing Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in this case to Erie versus Tompkins, because what he does is appear on the face to reduce or restrict the power of Congress by striking down a congressional statute or narrowly interpreting it. But what he's effectively done is enhance the judicial power, which is exactly what Holmes did in Erie, in my view.
Well, of course, Brandeis is the author of Erie, but
you're right. But Holmes sets
but
it up
beyond
in the taxi cab case before that, exactly.
But Erie, it seems to me, is a pretty fundamental decision with which we all would agree. It's a reaffirmation of federalism. There's not much in there about congressional power at all. It's a real, this is even a paraphrasing of the 10th Amendment and a real slap at the general federal common law. I don't understand the
that would be
the nationalism that you find in Erie.
Yeah, that would be subject for a whole other law review article, and I'll direct you to one I've got on it. Maybe
Dean
can get your but I do think in purporting to say, because what Erie does, and we're getting a little off track on our case today, but what Erie does is say the federal government has to take judge-made law from the states just as it takes statutory law. And that rejects the underlying notion of a natural law foundation for common law development. It was that natural law foundation that posed some limits on the federal judiciary as well. And by throwing it off in Erie, they give themselves a much freer hand to play mischief with judicial decisions than they had before. And it's a complicated argument, but it's not one that is unique to me. But I think there's something of that kind of sleight of hand that's going on in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion here as well.
Professor Rosenkranz, did you want to weigh in here?
No, that's John's point, not my point.
All right, let's take another caller.
Hi, this is Ken Masugi. Thank you all for the great discussion. John, I agree with you on your focus on progressivism in the particulars of Justice Thomas's opinion, but he does raise the Gentlemen's Agreement treaty, which allowed for certain rights of Japanese immigrants. And I wonder whether the problem isn't so much Missouri v. Holland, that is migratory birds, but migratory Japanese, or other immigrants whose rights might be secured through a treaty. I'd appreciate your thoughts on this.
My favorite migratory Japanese, Ken Masugi. This is why
I'm not an immigrant. I'm a native born. I got papers too.
That's right. It's a very good question, and I think my earlier reference to the treaties with Great Britain that ended the Revolutionary War, that had certain domestic applications, and dealt with how the United States would treat claims of property rights or torts rights by its own citizens because of the effect that it had on the foreign nationals. And I think what all Justice Thomas is doing there is conceding that the treaty power isn't limited to just nation versus nation relations, but how those nations treat each other's nationals. And that would certainly apply to the treaties on Japanese immigrants as well. The further point, though, is that's where the line has to stop. Because if a treaty says it's not about how the United States is going to deal with Canadians while they're visiting here, but how the United States is going to deal with Americans here, then it exceeds the treaty power. And Justice Thomas, I think, makes a powerful case for that. And that on that point, he's joined by Justice Scalia as well as Justice Alito.
And they're responding to a sort of conventional wisdom that you find in the restatement of foreign relations. This conventional wisdom, which is quite alarming, is the idea that treaties can be about any subject matter whatsoever. There is no subject matter limitation on the treaty power at all. And that's what Justice Thomas and Justice Alito in particular wanting to respond to. My hypothetical of agreeing with Zimbabwe, you know, we won't allow guns near our schools if you don't allow guns near your schools. That seems on its face to have nothing to do really with international things of international concern. But, you know, if you just read the restatement of foreign relations, you would think that was a fine treaty. And then if you read Missouri v. Holland, you would think that that gave Congress new power to regulate guns near schools. So that's, both aspects of that are troubling. And Justice Scalia is troubled by the increase in legislative power. Justice Thomas is troubled by the prospect of that treaty straight up. And they're both right, and both those ideas are, you know, deeply troubling and seemingly inconsistent with, you know, basic constitutional principles.
Well, and I think Justice Thomas also points to another problem, and that is this new restatement of foreign relations is the restatement third of foreign relations, which repudiates the former rule, which was treaties are between nation states, and really does adopt this progressive agenda that we can accomplish anything by treaty we want. And so people look at those restatement thirds as an agenda-driven goal rather than an actual restatement of what the law is, and you know, you'll be less reliant on it, and also much more likely to challenge it when it runs head on against basic constitutional principles.
I take it, Professor Rosenkranz, if Congress's power could be expanded under Missouri v. Holland by a treaty, that subsequently a president could unilaterally unsign a treaty and then unilaterally contract Congress's power.
That's quite right. It's a very odd kind of quirk of Missouri v. Holland, and a way of seeing what a crazy regime it creates. If it's true that a treaty can increase the legislative power of Congress, then it must be true that the legislative power of Congress can also be decreased. So if the president abrogates a treaty, for which he can do unilaterally, presumably the legislative power goes away, and the statute is now unconstitutional. And that's quite odd. I mean, you know, as a general matter, the president has a few days to sign or veto a statute, and after those few days, that's it. But as to this category of statute, in theory, the president can render statutes unconstitutional on his own motion unilaterally for any reason or no reason just by abrogating the treaty. And that is yet another way to see what a crazy regime is created by Missouri v. Holland.
And it's even worse than that, because in the hypothetical Nick set out earlier, Zimbabwe could abrogate the treaty and therefore render the statute unconstitutional.
And contract Congress's authority.
And or the King of England. I mean, to put the finest point on it, the framers would have been very surprised to learn that a U.S. statute duly enacted by both houses of Congress and signed by the president, might be supreme law of the land here in the United States right up until it is abrogated by the King of England. And yet, that's an implication of Missouri v. Holland.
Fascinating. We've got one caller pending. If you'd like to join the queue to ask one of the final questions, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question here.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. It's obviously offensive to constitutional conservatives that the Constitution could be overridden in the kind of manner we're discussing. But isn't it time to acknowledge that Randy Barnett is correct when he said we have to keep our eyes on the fact that there are really three questions in discussing whether laws violate the Constitution. First, does it violate the text or the original meaning? Second, does it violate any prior Supreme Court cases? And third, do we have five votes? And so it seems to me it's important to continue this kind of discussion and debate, to continue to litigate these cases, to continue to make these arguments. But we have to reach the hearts and minds of people through the whole judicial appointment process and continue to try and get constitutional conservatives on the court.
I agree. The one slight twist on it, that's one of the reasons we're doing these teleforums. But second is, we have to have five votes as a practical matter to prevail. But just because the other side continues to have five votes on these things doesn't make what they say constitutional. And I will fight that. And I know you're not suggesting that, but the implication, some have said, when the court ratifies something, it's therefore constitutional because the court has spoken. I fundamentally reject that notion, and we have to fight it with every ounce of our being, because the court cannot rewrite the Constitution any more than Congress can. As a practical matter, it has that effect, but it doesn't give it any legitimacy.
Let's get that engraved on a stone in front of the Supreme Court.
Yes, indeed.
So I quite agree with all of that. And just to strike a bit of a happier note here about this, we did get two, or depending on how you count, three votes for this proposition on Monday, and zero votes on the other side, because the other justices said nothing about this. So the score for us for this week is 2-0 or 3-0. So this is a win in a sense for us. It's true, five is what we need, but we didn't have votes against us. We now have a very strong opinion in the U.S. report saying a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress, and that's huge progress.
Well, thank you for that reminder, and thank you for helping bring that about.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, let me give each of our speakers a chance to express a final thought. Let's start first with Professor John Eastman.
Yeah, I'll end here where I began. If you look at this case in the context of a century-long fight about whether we're going to continue to have a constitution that is limited in its reach, this is an extremely important case. And Oliver Wendell Holmes' one-line sentence in Missouri versus Holland is a devastatingly bad opinion, and it needs to be overturned. But it's the entire doctrine, the progressive movement, that needs to be overturned with it. That it is emblematic of, and that is that we've got these barriers to government power that have to be dispensed with so that government can do more good. That is so anathema to the understanding of our founders about liberty, that they are rolling over in their graves when they see things like Missouri versus Holland, and I think they would be the first to join us in applauding Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas's opinions in this case.
Professor Rosenkranz, a concluding remark?
I guess my concluding remark is, just great appreciation for Justice Scalia's magnificent opinion in this case. So, I think we have to take our victories where we can get them. This is two justices on record in the U.S. report saying a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress. I want to say I think Justice Scalia's opinion is a masterpiece. And, I want to urge everyone on the call, if you're going to read anything more on this topic, read Justice Scalia's little concurrence. It's beautifully written, it's exactly right, and it will help us keep our eye on the ball in the future.
Well, this is once again Dean Reuter. Let me thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Professor John Eastman, Professor Nicholas Rosenkranz. This has been really interesting, and I want to thank our audience as well for dialing in and for joining the conversation. A reminder to the audience that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Monday, when we'll be talking about the closure of Gitmo, the potential closure of Gitmo, I should say, and potential legal fallout from that. That's next Monday. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.